This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents So You Want to Talk About Race by Ijeoma Oluo. This book is read by Bonnie Turpin. Introduction. So You Want to Talk About Race. As a black woman, race has always been a prominent part of my life. I have never been able to escape the fact that I am a black woman in a white supremacist country. My blackness is woven into how I dress each morning, what bars I feel comfortable going to, what music I enjoy, what neighborhoods I hang out in. The realities of race have not always been welcome in my life, but they have always been there. When I was a young child, it was the constant questions of why I was so dark, while my mom was so white. Was I adopted? Where did I come from? When I became older, it was the clothes not cut for my shape, and the snide comments about my hair and lips, and the teen idols that would never ever find a girl like me beautiful. Then it was the clerks who would follow me around stores and the jobs that were hiring until I walked in the door, and then they were not. And it was the bosses who told me that I was too loud, the complaints that my hair was too ethnic for the office, and why, even though I was a valued employee, I was making so much less money than other white employees doing the same job. It is the cops I can't make eye contact with, the Ubers that abandon their pickup, driving on instead of stopping when they see me. When I had my sons, it was the assumptions that they were older than they were, and that their roughhousing was too violent. It was the tears they came home with when a classmate had repeated an ignorant comment of their parents. But race has also been countless hours spent marveling at our history, evenings spent dancing and cheering to jazz and rap and R&B, cookouts with ribs and potato salad and sweet potato pie. It has been hands of women braiding my hair. It has been reading the magic of the words of Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, and Alice Walker, and knowing that they are written for you. It has been parties filled with jollof rice and fufu and Nigerian women wearing sequin-covered gowns and giant geles on their heads. It has been the nod to the black stranger walking by that says, "I see you, fam." It has been pride in Malcolm, Martin, Rosa, and Angela. It has been a room full of the most uninhibited laughter you've ever heard. It has been the touch of my young son as he lays his hand over mine and says, "We're the same brown." Race, my race, has been one of the most defining forces in my life, but it is not something I always talked about. Certainly not the way that I do now. Like many people, most of my days were spent just trying to get by. Life is busy and hard. There are work and kids and chores and friends. We spend a lot of time bouncing from one mini crisis to the next. Yes, my days were just as full of microaggressions, of the pain and oppression of racism, as they are now. But I just had to keep going on like normal. It is very hard to survive as a woman of color in this world, and I remember saying once that if I stopped to feel, really feel, the pain of the racism I encountered, I would start screaming and I would never, ever stop. So I did what most of us do. I tried to make the best of it. I worked 50% harder than my white coworkers. I stayed late every day. I dressed like every day was a job interview. I was over-polite to white people I encountered in public. I bent over backwards to prove that I was not angry, that I was not a threat. I laughed off racist jokes as if I didn't feel the sting. I told myself that it would all be worth it one day, that being a successful black woman was revolution enough. But as I got older, as the successes I had reached for slowly became a reality, something inside me began to shift. I would try to make my voice quieter in meetings, and I couldn't. I would try to laugh off the racist jokes, and I couldn't. I would try to accept my boss's reasons for why I could have my promotion, but not my raise, and I couldn't. And I started talking. I started to question. I started to resist. I started to demand. I wanted to know why it was considered a bad thing that I was opinionated. I wanted to know what exactly it was about my hair that was unprofessional. I wanted to know what exactly it was about that joke that people found funny. And once I started talking, I couldn't stop. I also started writing. I shifted my food blog into a me blog and started saying all the things that everybody around me had always said were too negative, too abrasive, and too confrontational. I started writing down my frustrations and my heartbreak. I started writing about my fears for my community and my family. I had started to see myself, and once you start to see yourself, you cannot pretend anymore. It did not go over well. My white friends, having grown up in Seattle, the majority of my friends were white, some of whom I'd known since high school, were not happy with the real me. This was not the deal they had struck. Yes, they would rage over global warming and yell about Republican shenanigans, but they would not say a word about the racial oppression and brutality facing people of color in this country. "It is not my place," they'd explain, when in frustration I'd beg for some comment. "I don't really feel comfortable." And as I looked around my town and saw that my neighbors were not really my neighbors, as I saw that my friends no longer considered me fun, I began to yell even louder. Somebody had to hear me. Somebody had to care. I could not be alone. Like dialysis, the old went out and in came the new. Suddenly, people I had never met were reaching out locally and from all across the country, in person and online, just to let me know that they had read my blog post, and in reading it, they felt heard. Then online publishers started reaching out to me, asking if they could republish my work. And locally, isolated and invisible people of color started reaching out, showing me that I did have neighbors after all. I was talking and writing at first for my very survival, not for anybody else's benefit. Thanks to the power and freedom of the internet, many other people of color have been able to speak their truths as well. We've been able to reach out across cities, states, even countries, to share and reaffirm that, yes, what we are experiencing is true. But the internet has a very wide audience. And even though we were writing for ourselves, the power of the hurt, anger, fear, pride, and love of countless people of color could not go unnoticed by white people, especially those who were genuinely committed to fighting injustice. While some had chosen to turn away, upset that this unpleasantness had invaded their space of cat videos and baby pictures, others drew closer, realizing that they had been missing something very important all along. These last few years, the rise of voices of color, coupled with the widespread dissemination of video proof of brutality and injustice against people of color, has brought the urgency of racism in America to the forefront of all our consciousness. Race is not something people can choose to ignore anymore. Some of us have been speaking all along and have not been heard. Others are trying out their voices for the first time. These are very scary times for a lot of people who are just now realizing that America is not, and has never been, the melting pot utopia that their parents and teachers told them it was. These are very scary times for those who are just now realizing how justifiably hurt, angry, and terrified so many people of color have been all along. These are very stressful times for people of color, who have been fighting and yelling and trying to protect themselves from a world that doesn't care, to suddenly be asked by those who've ignored them for so long, what has been happening your entire life? Can you educate me? Now that we're all in the room, how do we start this discussion? This is not just a gap in experience and viewpoint. The Grand Canyon is a gap. This is a chasm you could drop entire solar systems into. But no matter how daunting, you are here because you want to hear, and you want to be heard. You are here because you know that something is very wrong, and you want a change. We can find our way to each other. We can find a way to our truths. I have seen it happen. My life is a testament to it, and it all starts with conversation. There is a good chance that you, regardless of race, have tried to have these conversations in the past. There is also a good chance that they have not gone well, so not well that perhaps you have been afraid to ever have these conversations again. If that is you, you are not alone. Part of the reason I decided to write this book is because I regularly hear people of all races saying things like, "How do I talk to my mother-in-law about the racist jokes she makes?" Or, "I just got called out for being racist, but I don't understand what I did wrong." Or, "I don't know what intersectionality is, and I'm afraid to say so." People find me on online messaging platforms and beg me not to make their questions public. People create whole new email accounts so they can email me anonymously. People are afraid of getting these conversations wrong, but they are still trying, and I deeply appreciate that. These conversations will not be easy, but they will get easier over time. We have to commit to the process if we want to address race, racism, and racial oppression in our society. This book may not be easy as well. I am not known for pulling punches, but I've been occasionally thought of as funny. But it has been very hard to be funny in this book. There is real pain in our racially oppressive system, pain that I, as a black woman, feel. I was unable to set that aside while writing this book. I didn't feel like laughing. This was a grueling, heart-wrenching book to write, and I've tried to lighten a little of that on the page, but I know that for some of you, this book will push and will push hard. For many white people, this book may bring you face to face with issues of race and privilege that will make you uncomfortable. For many people of color, this book may bring forward some of the trauma of experiences around race that you've experienced. But a centuries-old system of oppression and brutality is not an easy fix, and maybe we shouldn't be looking for easy reads. I hope that if parts of this book make you uncomfortable, you can sit with that discomfort for a while to see if it has anything else to offer you. Most of the topics you'll find in this book address questions I'm asked most often in my day-to-day work. Some of these are topics that I wish I got more questions about. But these are all things that we need to be able to talk about. I hope that the information provided here, while nowhere near exhaustive, can help provide you with a starting point to move forward in your discussions with less fear. Yes, racism and racial oppression in America is horrible and terrifying. The feelings it brings up in us are justified, but it is also everywhere, in every corner of our lives. We have to let go of some of that fear. We have to be able to look racism in the eye wherever we encounter it. If we continue to treat racism like it is a giant monster that is chasing us, we will be forever running. But running won't help when it's in our workplace, our government, our homes, and ourselves. I am so glad you are here. I am so glad that you are willing to talk about race. I'm honored to be a part of this conversation with you. Chapter 1. Is it really about race? I mean, I just feel like we would have gotten further if we'd focused more on class than race. I'm sitting across from a friend at a coffee shop near my house. He's a good friend, a smart, thoughtful, and well-meaning person. I always enjoy his company and a chance to talk with someone who is also interested in world events. But I'm tired. I'm tired because this is the conversation I've been having since the 2016 election ended, and liberals and progressives have been scrambling to figure out what went wrong. What was missing from the left's message that left so many people unenthusiastic about supporting a Democratic candidate, especially against Donald Trump? So far, a large group of people, mostly white men, paid to pontificate on politics and current events, seem to have landed on this. We, the broad and varied group of Democrats, socialists, and independents known as the left, focused on identity politics too much. We focused on the needs of black people, trans people, women, Latinx people. All this specialized focus divided people and left out working class white men. That is the argument, anyways. It's what I and many others have heard throughout the very long presidential campaign. It's what I heard last campaign and the one before that. It's what every other white dude in my political science classes in college had to say. And although I'm tired because I have just had this conversation with multiple people for multiple hours the evening before, here I am having it again, hearing what I've always heard. The problem in American society is not race, it's class. Surely, if you improve things for the lower classes, you improve things for minorities, he adds, seeing the disappointment and weariness on my face. But I'm going to go ahead and engage in this conversation, because if I can just make some progress with one well-meaning white dude about why class will never be interchangeable with race, I'll feel a little better about our social justice movements. If you could do that, if you could improve things for the lower classes, it would, I say. But how? When he then recites the standard recommendations of strengthening unions and raising minimum wages, I decide to jump to the point. Why do you think black people are poor? Do you think it's for the same reasons that white people are? This is where the conversation pauses. This is where I see my friend first look at me puzzled, and then try to come up with ways to push back. I continue on, since I've already gone this far. I live in a world where if I have a black-sounding name, I'm less likely to even be called for a job interview. Will I equally benefit from raising minimum wages when I can't even get a job? My friend recalls that study, acknowledging that the discrimination I'm referencing is indeed a real thing that happens. If I do get a good job and do what society says I should do, and save up and buy a house, will I benefit equally when the fact that I live in a black neighborhood means that my house will be worth far less? Will I benefit equally when I'm much more likely to get higher mortgage rates from my bank, or predatory loans that will skyrocket in cost after a few years, causing me to foreclose and lose my home and equity and credit because of the color of my skin? I'm on a coffee and frustration-fueled roll now. If I am able to get what is considered a decent wage for the average American, but my son is locked up in jail like one in three black men are predicted to be, so I'm raising my grandkids on my meager salary, will stronger unions really raise me out of poverty? If I'm more likely to be suspended and expelled from school, because even since preschool, my teachers are more likely to see my childhood antics as violence and aggression, will a reduction in student loan costs help me when I was pushed out of education before completing high school? I'm ranting now. I'm talking fast to get it all out. Not because I'm angry, because I'm not, really. I know it's not my friend's fault that what he's saying is the prevailing narrative, and that it's seen as the compassionate narrative. But it's a narrative that hurts me, and so many other people of color. My friend pauses and says,
Well, what are we supposed to do then? Nothing? Can't we focus on this first to get everybody behind it and then address the race stuff?
To which I sigh and say, That's the promise that's been made to us for hundreds of years. Those are the words of every labor movement that managed to help white America so much more than everyone else. Those are the words that move everybody forward, but in the exact same place, with the exact same hierarchy, and the exact same oppressions. Those words are why the wealth gap between whites and blacks is just as bad as it was when Dr. King was leading marches. We're still waiting. We're still hoping. We're still left behind. Race, as we know it in the U.S., is closely integrated with our economic system. The system of racism functioned primarily as a justification for the barbaric act of chattel slavery and the genocide of indigenous Americans. You cannot put chains around the necks of other human beings or slaughter them wholesale while maintaining social rules that prohibit such treatment without first designating those people as somewhat less than human. And later, the function of racism was somewhat repurposed as a way of dividing lower classes, still with the ultimate goal of the economic and political supremacy of white elites. Yes, like many say, race is a social construct. It has no bearing in science. Many believe that because race was created by our economic system, because it is a lie told to justify a crime, a unilateral improvement of conditions for lower classes would address the economic and social disparities around race. Money is also a social construct, a series of rules and agreements we all made up while pretending that these pieces of paper are worth our entire lives. But we cannot simply stop thinking of money and it will cease to enthrall us. It has woven its way into every part of our lives. It has shaped our past and our futures. It has become alive. Race has also become alive. Race was not only created to justify a racially exploitative economic system, it was invented to lock people of color into the bottom of it. Racism in America exists to exclude people of color from opportunity and progress so that there is more profit for others deemed superior. This profit itself is the greater promise for non-racialized people. You will get more because they exist to get less. That promise is durable, and unless attacked directly, it will outlive any attempts to address class as a whole. This promise, you will get more because they exist to get less, is woven throughout our entire society, our politics, our education system, our infrastructure, anywhere there is a finite amount of power, influence, visibility, wealth, or opportunity, anywhere in which someone might miss out, anywhere there might not be enough. There the lure of that promise sustains racism. White supremacy is the nation's oldest pyramid scheme. Even those who have lost everything to the scheme are still hanging in there, waiting for their turn to cash out. Even the election of our first black president did not lessen the lure of this promise to draw people to their support of racism. If anything, the election strengthened it. His election was a clear, undeniable sign that some black people could get more. And then what about everyone else's share? Those who had always blatantly or subconsciously depended on that promise that they would get more because others would get less were threatened in ways that they could not put words to. But suddenly, this didn't feel like their country anymore. Suddenly, they didn't feel like their needs were being met. But aside from that one, mostly symbolic change of the race of our president, not much else had changed. The promise of racism has still held true in just about every demographic of socio-political, economic well-being. Black and brown people are consistently getting less. We, people of color, of course, are not the only people who have gotten less. Even without the invention of race, class would still exist, and does exist even in racially homogeneous countries. And our class system is oppressive and violent and harms a lot of people of all races. It should be addressed. It should be torn down. But the same hammer won't tear down all of the walls. What keeps a poor child in Appalachia poor is not what keeps a poor child in Chicago poor. Even if from a distance the outcomes look the same. And what keeps an able-bodied black woman poor is not what keeps a disabled white man poor, even if the outcomes look the same. Even in our class and labor movements, the promise that you will get more because others exist to get less calls to people. It tells you to focus on the majority first. It tells you that the grievances of people of color or disabled people or transgender people or women are divisive. The promise that keeps racism alive tells you that you will benefit most and others will eventually benefit a little. It has you believing in trickle-down social justice. Yes, it is about class and about gender and sexuality and ability. And it's also, almost always, about race. Talk about race is inevitable in today's society, but it often doesn't seem to get much farther than an argument about whether or not something is about race. Talk about race can feel like a horribly depressing rendition of who's on first. While some argue that these issues of racism must be addressed, others argue that these issues are not race issues. And after much frustration trying to determine whether or not the yet-to-be-had conversation is indeed about race, somebody gives up and walks away, leaving the original issue untouched. In the day-to-day, determining whether or not an issue is about race can be difficult, not only for white people, but for people of color as well. Rarely is there only one factor or viewpoint in a serious issue. Things are never cut and dry. And because we have come up in a society where talking about race is just not something you do in polite company, we don't have a lot of practice in putting words to racial issues. But it is difficult, if not impossible, to talk about race when we can't even agree that something is about race. And we have to start somewhere. If you are looking for a simple way to determine if something is about race, here are some basic rules. And when I say basic, I mean basic. 1. It is about race if a person of color thinks it is about race. 2. It is about race if it disproportionately or differently affects people of color. 3. It is about race if it fits into a broader pattern of events that disproportionately or differently affect people of color. Now, looking at this short list, it's easy to think, hey, that is far too broad. Almost anything can fall under those categories. And it's true. Almost anything can fall under these categories. Why? Because race impacts almost every aspect of our lives. Let's look a little deeper. It is about race if a person of color thinks it's about race. This may sound at first like I'm asking you to just take every person of color's word for it, as if they are infallible and incapable of lying or misinterpreting a situation. But the truth is, whether or not someone is fallible is beside the point. We are, each and every one of us, a collection of our lived experiences. Our lived experiences shape us, how we interact with the world, and how we live in the world, and our experiences are valid. Because we do not experience the world with only part of ourselves, we cannot leave our racial identity at the door. And so, if a person of color says that something is about race, it is. Because regardless of the details, regardless of whether or not you can connect the dots from the outside, their racial identity is a part of them, and it is interacting with the situation. Note, if you are a white person in this situation, do not think that just because you may not be aware of your racial identity at the time, that you did not bring race to your experience of the situation as well. We are all products of a racialized society, and it affects everything we bring to our interactions. Something can be about race, and that doesn't mean that it is only about race. When I talk about being followed in a store by a white clerk, it is about race, because regardless of the clerk's intention, I'm bringing with me my entire history of a black woman who is routinely followed around by staff or security when I shop in stores. This clerk herself may not be thinking of my race at all when she's following me. She may just be an overeager trainee. Or maybe she suspects everybody of stealing and follows all customers regardless of race. But she, for her possibly innocent intentions, is also bringing her white identity into the interaction, as someone who is not regularly followed by store personnel, and therefore would be unaware of the impact it would have on me to, once again, be followed around a store by a white clerk. She, too, is making it about race, whether she knows it or not. But while this issue is about race and the racial aspects should be addressed, it's also about training. As aggressively following customers of any race is bad business. It can be about all of these things, and it is. It is about race if it disproportionately or differently affects people of color. Often when talking about issues of race, I will receive messages from white people stating that what I'm talking about is not about race because they, a white person, too, suffer from said issue. Poverty cannot be about race if there are poor white people. Incarceration cannot be about race if there are incarcerated white people, and so on. Many white people who themselves often suffer from the same hardships that many people of color suffer from feel erased by discussions of racial oppression. In contrast, I'll also often hear from white people, often the very same white people, about successful black people that obviously debunk the theory that hardships are race-based. How can poverty be about race if Oprah exists? How can there be lack of representation in the entertainment industry when Beyoncé wins all the awards? Setting aside the fact that the racial exceptionalism of people of color does not detract from, but instead adds to, arguments of racial inequality, because honestly, we don't have to name a few successful white people to argue that they are doing comparatively well in society. There are enough that they don't even stand out. These arguments are a pretty extreme oversimplification of how racial oppression works. Racial oppression is a broad and cumulative force. It is not a system that puts all its eggs in one basket. And racial oppression will interact with many other privileges and disadvantages to produce a myriad of effects. So yes, you can have a black athlete who won the genetic lottery and combined it with a superhuman amount of dedication, and then sprinkle him with a lot of luck, and he will turn into a professional superstar earning tens of millions of dollars a year. And yes, you can have a white man born to riches who loses everything he has in the stock market and winds up living in the streets. And you can have a beautiful white woman born with disabilities that set her at a distinct socioeconomic disadvantage, and an able-bodied black woman who was able to claw her way to middle-class comfort. But when it's all tallied up, the end result will still show, more often than not, measurably different outcomes for people depending on race. There are very few hardships out there that hit only people of color and not white people, but there are a lot of hardships that hit people of color a lot more than white people. As I said earlier, just because something is about race doesn't mean it's only about race. This also means that just because something is about race doesn't mean that white people can't be similarly impacted by it. And it doesn't mean that the experience of white people negatively impacted is invalidated by acknowledging that people of color are disproportionately impacted. Disadvantaged white people are not erased by discussions of disadvantages facing people of color, just as brain cancer is not erased by talking about breast cancer. They are two different issues with two different treatments, and they require two different conversations. It is about race if it fits into a broader pattern of events that disproportionately or differently affect people of color. When I was in an abusive relationship, it was not just about one incident. It wasn't about the time he called me stupid, or the next time, or the next time. It wasn't about the time he threw our dishes in the trash because he didn't like how I washed them. It wasn't about the time he said he didn't want my friends to come over because he was sure they thought they were better than him. It wasn't about the time that he didn't talk to me for hours because I'd accidentally erased an important message on the answering machine. Actually, it was about those times, but it wasn't about just one time. It was about all of them. I'd try to talk about it with him, to bring it up. "It's not okay to call me stupid," I'd say. "So I lose my temper once, and now I'm abusive?" he'd reply, and before I knew what was happening, I'd be on the defensive, trying to defend my right to a relationship free of abuse, trying to say that no, calling a person stupid once did not qualify as abuse, but calling a person stupid a few times a week did. To him, it was just an individual incident, and the next abuse was also an individual incident, to be forgotten as quickly as the words left his mouth. To me, it was a daily onslaught of emotional pain, but whenever I tried to step back and look at the big picture, he'd pull me down to look at a tiny piece. "See this? It's so small. Why would you get upset about this little thing?" I could not address abuse in my relationship because I was too busy defending my right to even call it abuse. Often, being a person of color in white-dominated society is like being in an abusive relationship with the world. Every day is a new little hurt, a new little dehumanization. We walk around flinching, still in pain from the last hurt and dreading the next. But when we say this is hurting us, a spotlight is shown on the freshest hurt, the bruise just forming. Look at how small it is, and I'm sure there is a good reason for it. "Why are you making such a big deal about it? Everyone gets hurt from time to time," while the world ignores that the rest of our bodies are covered in scars. But racial oppression is even harder to see than the abuse of a loved one, because the abuser is not one person. The abuser is the world around you, and the person inflicting pain in an individual instance may themselves have the best of intentions. Another analogy. Imagine if you were walking down the street and every few minutes someone would punch you in the arm. You don't know who will be punching you, and you don't know why. You are hurt and wary and weary. You are trying to protect yourself, but you can't get off this street. Then imagine somebody walks by, maybe gesticulating wildly in an interesting conversation, and they punch you in the arm on accident. Now imagine that this is the last straw, that this is where you scream. That person may not have meant to punch you in the arm, but the issue for you is still the fact that people keep punching you in the arm. Regardless of why that last person punched you, there's a pattern that needs to be addressed, and your sore arm is testimony to that. But what often happens instead is that people demand that you prove that each person who punched you in the arm in the past meant to punch you in the arm before they'll acknowledge that too many people are punching you in the arm. The real tragedy is that you get punched in the arm constantly, not that one or two people who accidentally punched you in the arm might be accused of doing it on purpose. They still contributed to the pain that you have endured, a pain bigger than that one punch, and they are responsible for being a part of that, whether they meant to or not. And if you just punched somebody in the arm, that would not be the time to talk about how important it is to protect your right to gesticulate wildly, even if sometimes you accidentally punch people. Once you know that your wild gesticulation is harming people, even if you've been raised to believe that it's your God-given right to gesticulate as wildly as your heart desires without any thought of consequences, you can no longer claim it's an accident when somebody gets hit. As long as race exists, and as long as racial oppression exists, race will touch almost every aspect of our lives. That is not necessarily a bad thing. Race is more than just pain and oppression. It's also culture and history. Personally, my blackness is a history of strength, beauty, and creativity that I draw on every day. It is more that than the history of the horrors that racism has wrought. My blackness has its own language, its own jokes, its own fashion. My blackness is a community and a family, and I'm very grateful for it. Humans are resilient and creative beings, and out of a social construct created to brutalize and oppress, we've managed to create a lot of beauty. We can fight racial oppression while still acknowledging and appreciating that. While just about everything can be about race, almost nothing is completely about race. It is important that we are aware of the different factors in any situation of oppression or conflict. Please see the chapter on intersectionality for more very important discussion on this. A lot of people feel like acknowledging race in a problem will make that problem only about race, and that will leave a lot of people out. But race was designed to be interwoven into our social, political, and economic systems. Instead of trying to isolate or ignore race, we need to look at race as a piece of the machine, just as we'd look at class or geography when considering social issues. Race alone is not all you need to focus on, but without it, any solution you come up with just won't work. We live in a complex world, and when looking at socioeconomic problems in our society, we simply cannot come to a viable solution without factoring in race. We like to filter new information through our own experiences to see if it computes. If it matches up with what we have experienced, it's valid. If it doesn't match up, it's not. But race is not a universal experience. If you are white, there is a good chance you may have been poor at some point in your life. You may have been sick. You may have been discriminated against for being fat or being disabled or being short or being conventionally unattractive. You may have been many things, but you have not been a person of color. So when a person of color comes to you and says, "This is different for me because I'm not white," when you run the situation through your own lived experience, it often won't compute. This is usually where the desire to dismiss claims of racial oppression come from. It just doesn't make sense to you, so it cannot be right. But if you are white and you are feeling this way, I ask you this. Is your lived experience real? Are the situations you've lived through real? Are your interpretations of those situations valid? Chances are, if you are using them to decide whether or not other situations and opinions are valid, you think they are. So if your lived experience and your interpretation of that lived experience are valid, why wouldn't the lived experience of people of color be just as valid? If I don't have the right to deem your life, what you see and hear and feel, a lie, why do you have the right to do it to me? Why do you deserve to be believed and people of color don't? And if you are a person of color, know this. The world will try to tell you that what you are seeing, hearing, thinking, and feeling is wrong. The world will tell you that you do not know how to interpret what is happening to you and to your community. But you are not wrong. And you have just as much right to be heard and believed as anybody else. If you think it's about race, you are right. Chapter 2. What is racism? It was an argument with a coworker that started where many arguments with coworkers start nowadays, on the internet. This coworker had posted a meme about how poor people should be given drug tests if they want to get welfare benefits. You know the kind of post I'm talking about, one that sends a message like, "If I need a drug test to get a hard-working job, you should have one to get the free stuff my hard-working tax dollars are paying for." I've seen these memes countless times, and they are never anything less than a gut punch to me. I pointed out that as someone who had grown up on welfare and was subjected to this attitude her entire childhood, this sort of stigmatization really hurts poor people who are just trying to survive. Poor people shouldn't have to prove how much they deserve to have a roof over their heads and feed their children. There are a few ways to react when somebody tells you that your language is unintentionally hurting them, and while I was hoping for a quick apology or maybe just a quick correction, my coworker decided to double down on her claims and add that she thought that poor people should also be sterilized. Because a lot of women take advantage of the system by having more kids to get more money. Suddenly it was like I was on a TV talk show circa 1984 talking about welfare queens. I honestly didn't think that people really believed that myth anymore. A myth that was used to dehumanize a generation of welfare recipients. And as someone who wouldn't have existed had there been forced sterilization of poor people, I took offense to this comment. In addition, as someone aware of our country's racist history of forced sterilization of women of color, I knew how dangerous statements like these can be. The discussion became heated quite quickly, as my coworker tried to both state that she had not intended to offend me or my brother, who also worked at the same company and was witnessing this argument online, but maybe I needed to be less angry. Because this was why people like me got a bad reputation. Note, people like you is a good warning that a conversation is about to head into pretty racist territory. Shit got pretty intense. Black-on-black crime was even brought up, I believe. And an entire evening was dedicated to an emotionally draining and ultimately fruitless conversation. The next day, I was talking to a friend about the incident. I was still very upset about what had happened the night before. Believe it or not, I, like most people, really do just want to live in peace and not have four-hour-long arguments about race and poverty on the internet. And it is always a bit of a gut punch to realize that someone you have been sitting next to for months or even years secretly harbors views that deny your basic humanity as a black woman. No matter how many times it happens, I have yet to get used to it. It's really difficult to realize that you've been sitting next to someone capable of racism like that, I explained over coffee.
Whoa, 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 Ijeoma, my friend interrupted, literally putting a hand up to stop me from speaking further. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here.
Excuse me? I asked, stunned and confused.
You can't just go around calling anything racist. Save that word for the big stuff, you know, for Nazis and cross-burnings and lynchings. You're just going to turn people off if you use such inflammatory language.
I really, really wanted this to just be a matter of misunderstanding. I really wanted this to be a case where perhaps he just didn't know how harmful everyday racism is, and once he did, he would change his mind. I tried to explain the real danger of unchecked racism and microaggressions to people of color, but he wasn't going to hear it. There was real racism, as he defined it, which was a post-Reconstruction-era horror type of racism, and there was whatever I was talking about, which he wasn't comfortable categorizing, but he was pretty sure wasn't that big of a deal. The day-to-day reminders that I'm less than, that I should just learn to get over or find a more pleasant way to confront. He went on to discuss how his grandma, for example, said some racist things, but she was a kind person. And it would be cruel to call a harmless old lady racist and would only make her more racist. It seemed far more important to him that the white people who were spreading and upholding racism be spared the effects of being called racist than sparing his black friend the effects of that racism. No matter what I said, no matter how I described the effects that this sort of racism had on me and other people of color, he was not going to accept me using the word racist to describe it. That was when I learned that this was not a friend I could talk to about this really important part of my life. I couldn't be my full self around him, and he would never truly have my back. He was not safe. I wasn't angry. I was heartbroken. We couldn't talk about the ways in which race and racism impacted my life because he was unwilling to even acknowledge the racism that was impacting my life, and he was unable to prioritize my safety over his comfort, which meant that we couldn't talk about me. Probably one of the most telling signs that we have problems talking about race in America is the fact that we can't even agree on what the definition of racism actually is. Look at almost any discussion of race and racism online, and you'll see an argument pop up over who is racist, who isn't, and who has the right to claim they are suffering from racism. The most common definitions of racism, in my own summation, are as follows. 1. Racism is any prejudice against someone because of their race. Or 2. Racism is any prejudice against someone because of their race when those views are reinforced by systems of power. While these two definitions are very close to each other in many ways, the differences between these two definitions of racism drastically change how you look at and address racism in America. For the purposes of this book, I'm going to use the second definition of racism, a prejudice against someone based on race when those prejudices are reinforced by systems of power. And this is a definition I recommend you use in your day-to-day life if your goal is to reduce the systemic harm done to people of color by racism in America. Let me explain why. When we use only the first definition of racism as any prejudice against someone based on race, we inaccurately reduce issues of race in America to a battle for the hearts and minds of individual racists, Instead of seeing racists, racist behaviors, and racial oppression as part of a larger system. There are a lot of individual, unapologetic racists out there. They're easy to spot. They're the people sharing the Obama equals monkey memes. They are the people sewing swastikas to their jackets and talking about white genocide. This book is not for them, and they are not my primary concern. This book will not tell you how to get unabashed racists to love people of color. I'm not a magician. Furthermore, many of those people have very little real power on their own and tend to stay on the fringes of society. We, as a society, like our racism subtler than that. What special power virulent racists do have can often be thwarted by just staying away from wherever you see Obama is a Muslim signs. What is important is that the impotent hatred of the virulent racist was built and nurtured by a system that has much more insidiously woven a quieter, yet no less violent, version of those same oppressive beliefs into the fabric of our society. The truth is, you don't even have to be racist to be a part of the racist system. The dude shouting about black-on-black crime is reinforced by elected officials coding problem neighborhoods and promising to clean up the streets that surprisingly always seem to have a lot of brown and black people on them and end with a lot of black and brown people in handcuffs. Your aunt yelling about thugs is echoed in our politicians talking about super predators, while building our school-to-prison pipelines that help ensure that the widest path available to black and brown children ends in a jail cell. But a lot of the people voting for stop-and-frisk crime bills or increased security in schools would never dream of blaming racial inequity on black-on-black crime or calling a young black man a thug. In contrast, a lot of the racists holding white power signs aren't even registered to vote. It's the system and our complacency in that system that gives racism its power, not individual intent. Without that white supremacist system, we'd just have a bunch of assholes yelling at each other on a pretty even playing field. And may the best yeller win. But there is no even playing field right now. Over 400 years of systemic oppression have set large groups of racial minorities